Chapter 6 The God Story Of Waters and Winds. The children of Egypt, even the wisest and best instructed of them, had in general the most childish ideas about the nature of their nourisher God, that aspect and manifestation of divinity which the Abram people called El Shaddai, the God of feeding, and the children of Black Earth, Hapi, the onswelling, surging one, the stream which had built up their marvelous oasis between the deserts and fed their existence and their comfortable, pious life-and-death philosophy. In other words, the River Nile. They believed, and from generation to generation taught their children, that the river, God knew where and how, arose out of the underworld on its way to the Great Green, that is to say, the immeasurable ocean, as which they envisaged the Mediterranean, and that its subsidence, after its fructifying rise, was in the nature of a return to the lower world. In short, there reigned among them the most utterly superstitious ignorance on this whole subject, and only the fact that there was no more enlightenment, indeed rather less, in the rest of the world, got them through life at all in such a darkened state. True, in spite of it, they built up a mighty and magnificent kingdom, admired on all hands and holding out for many millennia, produced many beautiful things, and in particular were geniuses at dealing with the object of their uninstructedness, namely the river that fed them. Still, we who know so much more, in fact know everything, cannot but regret that none of us was on the spot at that time to lighten the darkness within their souls and give them real understanding of the nature of Egypt's great river. What a buzz it would have made in the seminaries and academies to be told that Hapi, far from having his source in the lower world itself having been rejected as a baseless superstition, was merely the outlet of the great lakes in tropical Africa, and that the food god, to become what he is, has first to be fed himself by taking in all the rivers that flow down westwards from the Ethiopian Alps. In the rainy season, mountain brooks, full of fine detritus, rush and tumble down from the heights and flow together to form the two watercourses which are, so to speak, the prehistory of the future river, the Blue Nile and the Atbara. These, then, at a later locality, namely at Khartoum and Berber, go together to bed and turn into the creative stream, the River Nile. For this, their common bed, about the middle of the summer, gradually becomes so full with the volume of water and liquid mud that the river spreads out widely over its banks, so widely, indeed, that the common epithet for it is the overflowing one. The flood lasts for months. Then, just as gradually, it subsides within its bounds. But the crust of mud, the deposit left by its overflowing, forms, as the seminarists well know too, the fertile soil of Kempt. But they would probably have been amazed and even embittered against the harbingers of truth when they heard that the Nile comes not from below, but from above, in the last analysis, from heights as high as the rain that, in other less exceptional countries, plays the fertilizing role. There, they used to say, meaning in the wretched foreign countries, the Nile is set in heaven, meaning by that the rain. And it must be confessed that a surprising intuition, almost approaching enlightenment, expresses itself in the florid phraseology, an insight, that is, into the relations existing between all the watercourses and water sources in the world. The rise of the Nile depends on the amount of rainfall in the high mountains of Abyssinia, but the rains, in turn, are actually cloudbursts from clouds formed over the Mediterranean and driven by the wind into those regions. The well-being of Egypt depends on how high the Nile rises. And in the same way, the well-being of Canaan, the land of Canaana, the Upper Retenu, as it was once called, or Palestine, as we in our enlightenment designate Joseph's homeland and his father's, is conditioned by the rains which, in the rule, fall twice in the year, the early rain in the late autumn, the latter rain in the early part of the year. For the country is poor in springs, and not much can be done with the water of the rivers that run in the deep gorges. So everything depends on the rains, especially on the latter ones, and from the earliest times The rainfall has been collected. If the rains do not come, if instead of the moisture-bearing west wind, it blows regularly from the south and east, from off the desert, then there is no hope of a harvest. Aridity, crop failure, and famine follow. And not only here, for if it does not rain in Canaan, then there are no downpours in the Ethiopian hills. The mountain torrents do not tumble down from the heights. The two nourishers of the nourisher are not nourished, at least not enough for him to become great, as the children of Egypt always put it, not great enough to fill the canals which carry the water to the higher levels. Then crop failure and want ensue, even here in the country where the Nile is not in heaven but on earth. And thus we see the connection between all the waters of the earth in their sources and courses. Though we ourselves are enlightened only in a general way on these matters, we see nothing strange, though much that is unfortunate, in the phenomenon that hard times come at the same time in all lands, not only in the land of mud, but also in Syria, the land of the Philistines, Canaan, even the countries on the Red Sea, probably even in Mesopotamia and Babylonia, and that the dearth was great in all lands. Yes, things can go from bad to worse. One year of irregularity, failure, and want can follow on another in ill-tempered succession. The strands of misfortune may spin themselves out over a number of years until even the fabulous number of 7 is reached. Or perhaps not quite 7, but then even 5 is bad enough. Joseph enjoys life. For 5 whole years now, the winds and the waters had behaved their best, and the harvest been so rich that in sheer gratitude people made a 7 out of the 5, and the 5 fully deserved it. But now the page turned. Pharaoh, maternally concerned for the kingdom of black earth, had unclearly dreamed, and Joseph had boldly interpreted. The Nile failed to rise because in Canaan the winter, that is, the latter rain, did not fall. It failed once. That was a misfortune. It failed twice, and that was ground for lamentation. It failed 3 times. There was blanching and blenching and wringing of hands. After that, it might as well keep right on failing and go down in the records as a 7 years' drought. We human beings, when so unnaturally visited by nature, always behave the same way. At first we deceive ourselves in our day-by-day minds about the nature of the event. We do not understand what it means. We good-naturedly take it for an ordinary, average episode. After we have gradually learned that it is extraordinary, a first-class calamity such as we could never have dreamed could attack us in our lifetime, we look back in amazement on our former blindness. Thus the children of Egypt. It was long before they grasped the fact that this which they were enduring was the phenomenon called the 7 lean years. It had probably come to pass before now. In earlier times, in their legendary history, it had played a gruesome role. But they had never thought of it as affecting themselves. Their dullness of comprehension was not even as excusable as short-sightedness sometimes is. For Pharaoh had dreamed, and Joseph had interpreted. That they had really experienced the 7 fat years might have been enough evidence that the 7 lean ones would come along in their turn. But during the fat years, the children of Egypt had put the lean ones out of their minds, as the man in the legend forgets the devil's bookkeeping. Now the day of reckoning was at hand. When the nourisher had been pitiably low once, twice, and thrice, they had to admit it. And a patent result of the admission was a vast enlargement of Joseph's reputation. Of course, that too had steadily waxed in the years of fatness. How much more now must his fame have increased when the incidents of the lean ones proved that the measures he had taken were inspired by the profoundest wisdom. In times of crop failure and hunger, a minister of agriculture is in a bad position. The dull-witted population, never at the best very reasonable, always tending to make their feelings their guide, lay the blame for disaster on the shoulders of the highest responsible official. But if that official have acted in time to erect a magic barrier against evil, so that even if it work great changes, it is at least robbed of its character of a major catastrophe. If the official have done this, then he is a glorious and awe-inspiring leader of men. Men living in a land which is theirs merely by adoption sometimes display the national traits more strongly than even the native-born. During the 20 years of Joseph's adoption into the land of Egypt, the typically Egyptian idea of careful, preventive preservation had got into his flesh and bones. He put it into practice. It was the motive for his acts, but it was a conscious motive, for he preserved enough distance from his guiding principle to keep in mind the truth that it was also popular with the Egyptians, and to deal accordingly. And this was a combination of sincerity and a sense of humor, which goes down better than sincerity by itself. And now his harvest time had come, and he reaped as he had sown. The sowing was his tax economy during the good years. The harvest time was the distribution, a crown business of proportions never son of Ray had known since the time of that god. For as it is set down and told in song and story, the dearth was in all lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. Which, of course, does not mean that there was not scarcity in Egypt, too. What the price of corn rose to in response to frenzied demand, anyone can imagine who has even a vague idea of the working of economic laws. He may grow pale at the realization, but at the same time, he will also see that this scarcity was controlled, as the plenty had been before, by the same shrewd and kindly man. That the scarcity lay in his hand, and he could wield it as he would. For Pharaoh, he had got out of it all that he could. But he did the same for those least able to cope with it, the little people. He did this by a combination of liberality and exploitation, of government usury and fiscal measures such as had never been seen before. His mingling of severity and mildness impressed everyone, even the hardest hit, as superhuman and godlike. For the gods do behave in just this ambivalent way, and one never knows whether to call it cruel or kind. The situation was fantastic. Agriculture was in a state that made the dream of the 7 singed ears not even a parable, but the bare, bald truth. The dream ears were burnt by the east wind, namely, Khamsin, a scorching southeaster. And now Khamsin blew all summer long, and throughout the harvest time, called Shemu, from February to June, almost without cease. Often it was a tempest like an oven, filling the air with a dust like ashes that coated the young growth. Whatever feeble green the unnourished nourisher had bred was charred by this desert breath. 7 ears, yes, actually and literally, there were no more. In other words, the ears were not there. The harvest was not. But what was there, in quantity most scrupulously dealt out, was corn. Every kind of grain and cereal in the royal magazines and pits up and down the river in all the cities and towns and their vicinage, throughout the length and breadth of Egypt, but only Egypt. Elsewhere there had been no provision, no building of bins, no foresight before the flood. Yes, in all Egypt, and only there, was bread. In the hand of the state, in the hand of Joseph, the superintendent of all that the heavens had given. And now he himself became like the heavens which gave and the river Nile which provides. He opened his chambers, not wide open, but with circumspection, and gave bread and grain to all who needed, and that was everybody. Egyptians, as well as strangers from afar, traveled hither to get food from Pharaoh's land, which now, more correctly than ever, was called a granary, the granary of the world. He gave, that is, he sold, to them that had, at prices not they but he fixed, corresponding to the extraordinary economic situation, so that he made Pharaoh gold and silver, and still could give, in more literal sense, to the little lean-ribbed. To them he distributed in measure what they clamored for. To the small farmers and the dwellers in the little guttered alleys of the big towns, gave them bread and grain, that they might not die. That was godlike. but it was a praiseworthy human pattern, too. There had always been good officials who, with justice, had had written in their tombs that they had fed the king's subjects in time of need, given to the widow, not favored the great before the small, and afterwards, when the Nile had once more grown, had not taken the peasant's arrears, that is, had not pressed for advance payment or a fixed date. The people thought of these tomb inscriptions as they saw Joseph's business methods, but since the days of Set, no official had shown such benevolence, or was equipped with such plenary powers and such a truly godlike manipulation of them. The grain business, superintended by a staff of 10,000 scribes and underscribes, reached out all over Egypt, but all the threads ran back to Menphe, into the palace of the king's shadow dispenser and universal friend. There was not one final decision upon sale, loan, or gift which he had not reserved to himself. The rich man, the landed proprietor, came before him and cried for grain. To him he sold for his silver and gold, making the sale conditional upon the modernization of the man's irrigation system, so that he should stop muddling along in feudal inefficiency. Thus he kept faith with the highest, with Pharaoh, into whose treasuries flowed the rich man's silver and gold. The cry of the poor came before him too, and to them he distributed from the stores for nothing, and again for nothing, that they might not hunger but eat. Herein he was true to his fundamental characteristic of human sympathy, to which we have already done justice and need not dwell longer upon it, though we might just say once more that it has to do with mother wit. For truly there was something deserving the adjective witty in Joseph's technique of combined largesse and exploitation. Despite hard work and heavy cares, he was always in high spirits, and at home would say to Asenath, his wife and daughter of the sun, "My girl, I am enjoying life." He sold abroad, too, at high prices, as we know, and studied lists of the cereals delivered to the nobles of the wretched retainu. For many city kings of Canaan, among them the kings of Megiddo and Shahuran, sent to him for grain. The envoy from Ascalon came and cried before Joseph on behalf of his city, and was given at a price. But here, too, Joseph struck a balance between strict interest and friendliness, and starving sand rabbits, shepherd stock from Syria and Lebanon, barbarians who do not know how to live, as his scribes said, he allowed to enter with their flocks past the well-guarded gates of the land and east of the river toward Stony Arabia to find a living on the fat pastures of Zoan, on the Tanitic arm of the Nile, if they promised not to trespass beyond their allotted territory. Thus he would get from the frontier reports which ran like this: "We have passed Bedouins from Edom through the fortress of Menaptah and toward the lakes of Menaptah to pasture their flocks on the great meadows of Pharaoh, the exalted son of the lands." He read very carefully. He read all the frontier reports with the utmost care, and by his orders they had to be precise. He ordered a tightening of the regulations governing the entry of all persons through the eastern border fortresses into that rich land which now had become so uniquely rich. There had to be a list of names of every person coming out of the lands of wretchedness to fetch food from Pharaoh's corn bins. Frontier officials, like that Lieutenant Horwaz of Fell, scribe of the great gate who had once passed Joseph himself with his Ishmaelites into the land, had to take great pains with such lists, and to record all immigrants, not only according to their names, trades, and places of origin, but also by their fathers' and grandfathers' names. The lists then had to be sent daily by a fast messenger down to Menphe, to the offices of the king's shadow dispenser. There they were copied out fair on extra good paper with red and black ink, and laid before the provider. And he, though quite busy enough without that, read them through every day from beginning to end, as carefully as they had been compiled.